Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Again, I'm Brett Ordaway. This is Madison McWithey on behalf of Angel Grimaldo. This is an interesting case, and it's interesting from a factual and a legal perspective. Factually, it kind of goes without saying. We have this drunken sort of family reunion, resentment over an old affair, fleeing on a mobility scooter. More importantly, legally, we have two really good issues in this case. And I know that, at least in my experience, that's not always the case in criminal appeals. And I hope to talk about both issues this morning. So I'm going to proceed at a pretty good clip if this court will allow it. I want to start with our first issue, what I'll call our McCoy issue, because that is the issue that entitles us to the greatest relief, which is an entirely new trial. The first thing I want to emphasize here is that a McCoy claim is decidedly not a Strickland claim. A Strickland claim, as this court, I'm sure, knows, comes with a prejudice analysis and a thick layer of deference to counsel's decision making. A McCoy claim comes with neither of those things. So unlike a Strickland claim, which is ill-suited to direct appeal, a McCoy claim is really well-suited to direct appeal. And you see that in all the cases from the Texas courts that have followed McCoy, tackling these issues on the merits on direct appeal. Like Strickland, however, a McCoy claim comes with a two-prong analysis. The questions are, first, whether the defendant expressly exerted his will to maintain his innocence, and second, whether his attorney nonetheless conceded guilt. So I'll go through them in that order. So, yes, both of which are contested by the state. So on the first prong, whether Mr. Grimaldo expressly asserted that he wished to maintain his innocence, I want to emphasize at the start that this is nothing like the Candelaria case that we cited in our brief, where all they had to point to was the not guilty plea. That's clearly not good enough, but that's not what we have here. Admittedly, our best example of Mr. Grimaldo's expressing his will to maintain his innocence came at that first pretrial hearing. And it is a very good example of it. He says, and I quote, "I want to prove my innocence." It doesn't really get any more clear than that. The issue is with the timing. Again, this came.
Does context make a difference because the state is arguing here that this was done during a motion to withdraw by his lawyer, and so it has something to do with. I've not gone and read the entire record yet, but does that make a difference?
I don't see why it would. I mean, to me, it's just as clear as day. I want to prove my innocence only means one thing. So I don't think that makes any difference. I think the issue is just with the timing that this occurred.
So talking about timing, it seems that the state seems to argue that the difference and the factual difference in the McCoy case is that in McCoy, he continuously throughout trial continues to proclaim his innocence, as opposed to they argue differently in the Nixon case, which was the case they argued in the brief, which is just done more so like maybe the Grimaldo case just at the beginning. So does there have to be almost this continuous, they almost seem to make an argument that it has to be continuous throughout the trial, this innocence, or is one innocence claim enough?
I think that one is enough. I think that none is clearly not enough. Like that, I think, is the situation in the Nixon case, the Florida versus Nixon case that preceded McCoy. I think none is clearly not enough, but I think that one is enough. Certainly in McCoy and then in Turner, the leading CCA case interpreting McCoy, you have repeated instances. There are more than we have here, but I don't think that anything in Turner or McCoy can be read to say that that is necessary. It just makes the claim stronger.
So is it detrimental to your client then, however, that he did not complain or proclaim his innocence at the time where the concession of guilt is made during closing arguments? Because at that point, there wasn't made any proclamation of innocence or objection.
Yeah, so I think that it would be kind of absurd to expect a defendant to stand up in the middle of his attorney's closing argument and say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, I did not condone this." And I don't think that you could expect the trial court to do the same thing either. The state in its brief emphasized that this first pretrial hearing also had a different judge than the eventual judge presided at trial. And for that same reason, I don't really think that that is of much concern. When we talk about preserving a McCoy issue. I don't think it's preservation in the sense that you would expect a lawyer to object immediately to the admission of evidence, giving a trial judge an opportunity to rule on it in the first instance. When we talk about preserving a McCoy claim, and I'll note that the word preserve never appears in McCoy. That's from Turner, where the state argued that it had to be preserved, and the CCA said there that it was preserved because he timely asserted that he wanted to maintain his innocence. All preservation means in a McCoy context is that the assertion of the will to maintain his innocence has to come before the concession. You can't have a concession and then after the fact say, I did not want him to do that. It's got to be in that order.
Regarding the concession that the claim was made during the closing argument, was this during the guilt innocence phase or during the punishment phase?
It was during the guilt innocence phase, and then it was repeated in the punishment phase. And we emphasize this in our brief as to kind of show that this was a trial-spanning theme on counsel's behalf. It was the way he approached the entire trial was that, look, this is clearly a punishment case. We're going to go through the motions at guilt, but this is a punishment case. And so that's why we emphasize those later instances in our brief, not to fault counsel for making those concessions then. That is a different issue, conceding guilt at punishment. A McCoy claim is about that guilt phase concession. We emphasize those just to demonstrate the trial-spanning theme. And one other thing I want to point to on that subject is that on page 8 of volume 8 of the record, you have trial counsel talking to the court outside the presence of the jury. And counsel says, I have been diligently and efficiently working to bring this matter to a conclusion, first endeavoring to work out a reasonable plea offer. So I think it's clear when you look at the entirety of the record that our reading of the closing argument is the correct one. If you have any doubt about it, you can just look at these later instances of counsel talking to the court and of the punishment phase closing arguments that demonstrate that this was counsel's trial-spanning theme. In terms of the timing, I'll just go back to the first prong here briefly because there is one point I want to make. I agree with the state that it's more problematic that the attorneys changed between that first pretrial hearing and the later one. I view that as a worse fact for us than the fact that the judges changed. But what I want to emphasize here is that the eventual attorney, the attorney who made the concession, was appointed just one day after that statement, I want to prove my innocence, was made. That statement was made at a hearing about Mr. Grimaldo's dissatisfaction with his previous attorney. So 24 hours later, you have the new attorney on the case. And so it's not like there's a giant gap between that statement and the new attorney. And really just the last thing I'll say on this subject is that I think that in every McCoy case, there's always going to be an inference made by a court that the trial attorney is doing something that his client did not want. Unless you have a record where the defendant is saying, I don't want you to concede guilt, and then a split second later, counsel stands up and concedes guilt, there's always going to be some time span, some opportunity for the defendant to have changed his mind. So the court is always ultimately going to be making an inference that this was against Mr. Grimaldo's or against the defendant's wishes. And so here, I think that when you look at the totality of the record, you look at that initial assertion, those later assertions that we pointed to in our brief, it is clear that Mr. Grimaldo had no interest in conceding anything in this case. He wanted to prove his innocence. His counsel nonetheless conceded that he had attempted to work out a plea bargain, which I think, as even the state acknowledges, is at least a concession of guilt of a lesser offense, which was the situation in McCoy itself. So I think that we have both McCoy prongs satisfied, and that Mr. Grimaldo is entitled on his first point to a new trial.
Well, the third example that you gave him begging his attorney to recall his brother Joseph, how was that going to, how does that hold for this argument?
Well, I think that it demonstrates that he has no interest in just moving on to the punishment phase the way his attorney does. He is begging his attorney to fight this as best as he can, but his attorney agrees that with the court, I believe, that it's a waste of time. And so, you know, again, we highlight this to show the bigger picture, that clearly he is not on board with any strategy that has him laying down and waiting until the punishment.
Does that strategy that comes with the brother testifying have anything to do with whether he's maintaining his innocence, or was it something else within the case itself? Or is there any record of what that was about?
I don't think that there's any clear record of what that was about, because I know that there was a later instance in which he wanted his attorney to recall a different witness, but that was based on punishment being stacked, and so that was why that's why we didn't emphasize that in our brief. Here, he just wants his brother to be recalled during the guilt phase, so I think that was because he is trying to prove that he is not guilty. He does not want to move on to punishment. And with just 5 minutes left, I'd like to move to my second point, if I can. Our second point relates to the trial court's instruction that Mr. Grimaldo was eligible for good conduct time, for his sentence to be reduced through the award of good conduct time. There is no question that this was incorrect. The state concedes it in its brief. And it is somewhat of a forgivable error, because what the trial court did is just used an old charge in which that was the proper instruction. The legislature changed that and deleted the references to good conduct time, in my mind, because it is obviously egregiously harmful to tell a jury that a defendant can have his sentence reduced by something that doesn't exist, at least for that defendant.
Are you arguing to this court that we should then, since it is a wrong instruction that everybody mm-hmm. agrees, that we don't do a harm analysis?
No.
It's egregious harm on its face.
No, I wouldn't argue that. I don't think a bright line rule like that would ever survive at the CCA. I think you'd be begging to be reversed there. And I want to point out that in Schamberger, which is our best case, there is not a bright line rule there either. Respectfully, I think this court's sister court in Weaver, the state cited by the case, misread Schamberger. It is not a bright line rule. In Schamberger, the court reversed because you had this instruction and you had the jury note in that case asking about parole. We don't have a jury note here. Our theory of this is that this case is like Schamberger. You swap out the jury note, you add in the closing argument emphasis by both parties on parole. And then one other thing that I really regret that we didn't mention in our brief, but I want to emphasize now, which is that the charge in this case is actually worse than the charge in Schamberger, because there are two additional instances of good conduct time being mentioned in the charge. You have that first sentence in the parole instruction saying he can earn time off, but then you also have the court telling the jury it can't be accurately predicted how the parole law and good conduct time might be applied, and you have the court telling the jury you may consider the existence of the parole law and good conduct time. So you have three instances in this charge where the jury is being told that good conduct time is a thing, and it's just not for Mr. Grimaldo. So to my mind, as a defense attorney, I just can't imagine how that could not be harmful to tell a jury that his sentence could end up being shorter than it actually could be. The only other point I want to make here is that in the state's brief, it argues that the rest of the charge was fine. So as I said, that's not really correct. There are additional instances of good conduct time. But I know that this is a factor under Almanza, the rest of the charge. Candidly, this has kind of always bothered me. It kind of reminds me of that old joke about asking Ms. Lincoln how the play was otherwise. It's like if there was one error in the charge and it was bad enough, who cares how the rest of the charge was? But what I want to emphasize here is that even if you didn't have these additional references to good conduct time, there is nothing in the rest of the charge that ameliorated the harm. So like what you'll often see
in- just because we're running out of time, what if we find the instruction is egregiously harmful? Mm-hmm. What is the review or the outcome of the case? Is that portion, or does the whole case have to go back? I was unclear as to what would be the disposition of the case.
I think the remedy in that case would be just to grant a new sentencing hearing. Okay. So, yeah, so that's a lesser remedy than on the first ground. And, yeah, just the last thing I wanted to say on that is that, you know, a lot of times in these cases, You'll see like an error defining a term in one part of the charge, but then it's correctly defined in another part of the charge. So when we look at the entirety of the charge, it's hard to say that there's egregious harm. Here you don't have that. There's no correction of this in a different part of the charge. And again, there's those two additional instances where you're talking about good conduct time. My time is up. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Morning. May it please the court, counsel for the appellant. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Arnold Hayden. I'm an assistant criminal district attorney for Calhoun County. And on behalf of Sarah Rodriguez, our elected district attorney, and the citizens of Calhoun County, I am glad to represent the state of Texas in this case. I want to start with the same position that the appellant started out, and that's the factual issues. And the one fact that the appellant never talked about is what this case is really about. It's about Angel Grimaldo getting into his car, backing up, ramming his vehicle into the back of a Suburban, hitting his sister-in-law and severely injuring her, and then backing up again and ramming the car into the house, hitting his other sister-in-law. And that is an unescapable fact of this case. I called it abhorrent in my brief, and I stand before you and believe that it is an abhorrent act. The defense, or the appellant, in both of his points is trying to avoid analyzing that harm. He's trying to avoid a harm analysis under Strickland by urging a McCoy issue, and he's trying to avoid that issue when he's talking about the jury charge in this case, because he completely avoids how fair the sentence is when evaluating this case under the factors.
Well, what I found interesting in reading the McCoy and the Nixon case and the Turner case is in all those cases, it's almost unbelievable that because of the evidence that those appellants or those defendants were trying to claim their innocence in light of the evidence before. There seems to be that common thread of even if everything is stacked up against you, the defendant still has a right to plead his innocence. And so I understand the it seems like all these cases are really serious criminal cases.
Well, I think that that's why the holding in McCoy is what it is, because these are all back against the wall death penalty cases. But it also, the McCoy and recognize that these are rare cases. And since the Court of Criminal Appeals decided Turner, I haven't been able to find a single Texas case that was reversed on McCoy issues. It is an issue that can be handled on direct appeal, but you need the right record. And that's not what you have in this case. Since you brought up Nixon, I'd like to direct the court to Ex Parte Barbie, because I think it illustrates how the Court of Criminal Appeals would analyze this case should it get to that level. I think Nixon is important in this case, because in Barbie, the Court of Criminal Appeals denied a death penalty case, denied a writ of habeas corpus on the grounds that a McCoy issue could have been brought as a Florida v. Nixon case.
But the Barbie case is a different procedural animal, right? He's bringing a McCoy issue because he says his McCoy issue was not available to him at the time. And is saying, well, this is a new issue, a new remedy, I love it. And the Court of Criminal Appeals said, McCoy's always been around. The underlying right in McCoy has always been around. And so that's why they threw Barbie out.
Well, no, but I agree with you on the holding, but the analysis of McCoy and the interplay between Strickland and Nixon is what's important in that case, because it shows how the Court of Criminal Appeals, it shows the Court of Criminal Appeals believes this is a very narrow opinion, and that it's a very high bar to meet these elements. And what that opinion says is that in order to have structural error, you have to have the record showing that the attorney and the judge knew that that the defendant did not want to concede guilt, that they were going to maintain innocence. There has to be a clear concession, and the trial judge has to ignore that concession and allow defense counsel to continue. And that's what's really missing.
Because the first one that was made when he said, and during the motion for the trial counsel, and he said, I want to prove my innocence,
I don't think it's timely, because there's no way to know whether the trial court that actually heard the case knew about that, or that the trial counsel knew about that.
Shouldn't the subsequent judge or subsequent court be charged with knowledge of what's happened in the case before?
I think so, but the context of that complaint was an emotional withdrawal where the whole issue was the competency of the attorney.
Well, the whole issue, I think that we see them a lot in these motions to withdraw defense counsel, is that there's always an argument where they feel like their lawyer's not doing their job for them because they want to prove their innocence, and the lawyer's pushing them for plea deals or telling them the evidence is against them. Whatever argument that I see, that it would always arise in a motion to disqualify, motion to get new counsel, some kind of definitely a tension situation that would occur between the defendant and his attorney.
I mean, that's the state's concern, is that this would be such an expansion of McCoy that it would apply in every case.
Very much so. Yeah. I mean, how do we go from a Strickland ineffective counsel to a McCoy?
I mean, I think you have to have a very narrow view of McCoy, because all the cases that are going to raise McCoy, they're raising it because they have a serious problem on that writ, answering the prejudice problem, because they're incredibly guilty.
And my point I was going to make in relation to that is that wouldn't it then become a trap for the state if it wasn't a high bar, because then you just bring your defendant in and say, I'm innocent, and then in passing during questioning or closing, you say something about his guilt, and then all of a sudden you drop.
Well, that's my concern, is how does the state protect the record in these cases? Are we going to have to jump up and object every time the defense attorney says anything, makes any concession to any part of the evidence? Because defense attorneys, and I was a defense attorney myself, you do that in order to get credibility with the jury. And we talked about lesser included or alternate charges, but the fact is there were no lessers in this case because there were no uncontroverted facts. You had 9 eyewitnesses say that their client ran over his sister-in-law with a car. And that's how all these cases are. But what you have to do is apply these rules in a way to where there's a difference between someone who is actually maintaining their innocence and someone who is just trying to delay the process in order to avoid a consequence.
What do you propose to be the clearest way for a defendant to do that?
The clearest way is for them to testify. And that's what you had in McCoy.
Yeah, you can't do that
What?
You can't have one constitution for the
they should. I mean, there's a presumption of defense attorney competence, and that it should always be under control of the defendant. But in these cases, you have, it's like the pounding of a drum. These people are making a record for themselves because they can't control themselves. And it's obvious. And if you don't have that record, well, you have a fallback in Nixon and in Strickland that can come up on a writ. That you have to have an almost perfect record to have a McCoy issue on direct appeal.
Well, there's never a perfect record.
There isn't.
Even the McCoy, I mean, it had its dissents from, I think it was illegal to write the dissent, because even that wasn't perfect record.
Yeah.
It had a lot of McCoy standing up and being unruly in the middle of the trial, proclaiming his innocence,
Yeah, well, and I mean, there are often competency issues also involved in these types of situations. But I think it's one of those subjective things, kind of like obscenity, that you should really know it when you see it. You shouldn't have to stretch and distort the record in order to preserve error on McCoy. And going on to the second prong, you also shouldn't have to distort the record in order to see a concession. And it's our position that in no way was Mr. Beeler's point in closing argument a concession. All he was trying to do was create distance between the jury and his client by saying, hey, we tried to avoid a trial. That doesn't mean that they wanted to plead guilty. It could mean they wanted the case dismissed, which, outside the record, that's what was going on. Or they wanted some other type of charge that they couldn't get as a lesser. Or anything. Attorneys negotiate cases all the time to try to get to a solution that their clients want. And just because you reference that.
Now, the important thing is what did the jury, reasonable understanding of the jury, the jury's not going to know about all the technical type issues.
Well, I mean, I don't. I don't think the jury was fazed at all because every other sentence in the closing argument was about why they should find his client not guilty. And really, I mean, this is a rhetorical device that set up the argument that the appellant was referencing in punishment. But the error on a McCoy issue happens in guilt innocence every single time. And it's complete. The trial court does not stop the concession. That's what Barbie says. And you have to give the trial court a chance to cure the error. And if the trial court doesn't know what's going on, the defense attorney doesn't know that they're making concession, the jury doesn't know, the state doesn't know, then you don't have a McCoy issue. These are desperate situations, often in death penalty cases, where you're putting all your chips on the table, and that's not what happened in this case. And there's no evidence on the record that this had any impact on the jury. It's just, it's a short sentence made in the middle of a closing argument. So I'd like to move on to the punishment issue. I think that, you know, this is a common error that, you know, just most attorneys don't know about. We'll definitely never commit this error again in Calhoun County. But and the other thing is most defense attorneys don't know about it, so it doesn't get objected to. So you're in a situation where you're having to find egregious error. And it's kind of ironic that a McCoy issue is being brought alongside an issue like this about, you know, egregious harm and punishment, because McCoy issues come in very strong cases. And this is a very strong case where you had a lot of evidence of this person doing a horrible thing to their own family. And on top of that, you have punishment evidence where the jury finds out that he was on probation for a continuous assault of a family member at the time of the offense. He had had several felony probations, one for an assault of a public servant. He's been in and out of trouble his entire life. You have both his wife and his girlfriend testify that he was abusive, not only physically, but sexually. You have a huge amount of evidence that would suggest a sentence on the high end of 5 to 99 in this case, and the jury came back 20. And you have to consider that. That's part of the Almanza factors. You have to find actual harm to the defendant. And you know, Calhoun County doesn't want to try this case on punishment again, not just because we don't want to put the victims through it again, but we don't think it's fair to the defendant. Because there's a good chance he's going to get popped. A very good chance. And that's why you have the discussion when the judge stacked this case and ordered that it run consecutively, where the defense was like, hey, y'all are just mad you didn't get a big sentence. You know, part of that's true. And you have to consider that what's actually going to happen to the defendant if you send this case back on a punishment hearing.
I agree, but I am troubled by the fact that we are giving juries something that the legislature recognized should not be given to jurors, because jurors are taking it the wrong way. And so once you give it to the juror, there's no way now that we cannot think that the jurors, you may think that 20 is not enough, but I'm not sure that Mr. Grimaldi would agree with you on this aspect of the case. But did they do any type of taking into account in their deliberations? We have to assume that they did, because it's in the charge. And the inference is, we assume the jurors follow the charge, which means they took the time into account, which the legislature has said they can't do, it's wrong. And how does that not rise to a duty?
Well, I think that's one of the issues that Schamburger is based on, but the Dallas court has really backed themselves away from that. And what we have in Texas jurisprudence is this assumption that the jury follows the charge. And right after we introduce the concept of good conduct time, we tell them they can't consider good conduct time. And it's an academic discussion between the defense bar and the legislature why this had to be changed. But when you look at the actual facts of this case, no one was talking about good conduct time. When I stood up in front of the jury and told them I wanted to talk to them about parole, it's because I was explaining the difference between 99 and life. Because in this area, that's the most common note you get from a jury. What's the difference between 99 and life? No one was talking about good conduct time, because they were talking about, well, if you give this, he's got to do half. And that's the state of the law. And that's all I think we can assume that the jury was considering. And if you were going to look at the charge and say that, well, you know, you said good conduct time, so they're going to think about this, then you also have to give credit to the fact that the charge said not to consider good conduct time. So I also think there's a situation where if the jury sent out a note where you had a proper charge and the jury sent out a note asking about good conduct time, if you sent the old charge back, it would probably be proper because it's a correct statement of the law. I see I have some time left. Are there any other questions? Otherwise, I'll summarize the issues here and give back the rest of my time. Ladies and gentlemen, this case is about a man who terrorized his own family and ran over two of his sisters-in-law, causing serious injury to one of them, permanently disfiguring her. She almost lost her foot. She lost her business. She had to move. She's estranged from her family. That's what this case is about. And do not expand. Do not get caught in the academic appeal of these issues. This is a real case to real people, and the law in the Court of Criminal Appeals has really no interest, I believe, in expanding the law in this area. And that's what the appellant is asking you to do. And it's the same issue that we've always had with this case. They're doing this to avoid the consequence. And that's all that would happen. Because in the end, there were 9 people, eight of them related to the defendant, who saw him run over our victim with a car. And while the state believes that 20 years wasn't enough, we have no interest in having another hearing on that matter. And that's why we're asking you to affirm the trial court and deny relief on both issues. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, well, and y'all give great academic opinions, and I'm a law nerd too, but I've always got to advocate for our victims and bring it back to the facts. And the facts in this case are abhorrent, and they're never going to go away no matter how many times we have to try this case. Thank you.
I completely understand why the state wants to hammer on the facts in this case. It makes total sense. But the fact of the matter is that the jury clearly did not agree with the state in its estimation of how much time Mr. Grimaldo deserved. And on the point of the parole issue, I'll go in reverse order here. The state is kind of right when it talks about what the jury instruction says. The jury instruction says, and I quote, "You may consider the existence of the parole law and good conduct time." The next sentence is, "You are not to consider the extent to which good conduct time may be awarded or forfeited," which has always kind of confused me. It's kind of like saying two things at once. But it is wrong to say that the jury was told not to consider good conduct time. They were told just the opposite. And the only other point I want to make on this second issue is that good conduct time is parole and vice versa. In the charges are separated by one word, and in Schamburger, the Dallas Court of Appeals explained that when you're talking about one, you are necessarily talking about the other. So whether the words good conduct time were mentioned in closing argument or not, this hammering on the subject of parole was putting the jury in the mindset to be thinking about parole when they were reaching their sentence, which was far less than the state believed was appropriate in this case. So I just don't really think that the state's estimation of the facts on the second ground is in line with what the jury clearly thought.
How do you respond to the state's argument regarding the punishment being at the low end of the range? How we should consider that?
Well, I think that the important thing here is that it was not at the bottom of the range. So it was, the minimum could have been 5, and the jury gave him 20, knowing that good conduct time was, that he was eligible for good conduct time. So there was plenty of room for the jury to go up from the minimum on the assumption that good conduct time was, that he was eligible for it. So that's what I think really matters here, the distance from the minimum, not the distance from the maximum. On the first issue, I want to be very clear. The facts don't matter at all on the McCoy issue. The state said that there is no evidence that this had any impact on the jury. I don't care. That has nothing to do with this issue. As you pointed out, Your Honor, this issue originally arose in these horrible death penalty cases. It has nothing to do with the facts of the case. The point is that some decisions still are the province of the defendant, and that this is one of them. So the facts just don't matter. Just two other...
But we do have to recognize that if a defendant just comes and says one time and says, I'm innocent, I'm pleading not guilty, just the plead enough is not enough for a McCoy. It has to be more than that, or we will turn this upside down. It's just how much more of it is that?
Well, I think that that's right, and I think that that is actually the only real area in which the Barbie case is useful for this case. You know, Barbie is primarily about the subsequent writ bar, but Barbie did draw this distinction between saying, I am innocent, and I want to prove my innocence. To me, that's a little bit of a tortured distinction, but in any event, here, Mr. Grimaldo did not say, I am innocent. He said, I want to prove my innocence. The CCA views those as different things, but that's fine in this case because that's what he said. I want to prove my innocence. The last two points I just want to make, I talked about this earlier, but again, I really don't think that this is about setting it up for the trial court to interrupt the interrupt the defense attorney. I do not think that that is what preservation means in a McCoy context. I think, frankly, it's kind of absurd to expect a trial judge to interrupt a lawyer in the middle of his closing argument. And then just my last point, and I talked about this in the reply brief, the state has kind of surprised me with this slippery slope argument about how we're going to have a McCoy error in every case. I guess the state talked about outside the record, so I'll talk outside of the record. Every attorney I've talked to can't believe that the trial attorney said at the guilt phase of trial, I'm sorry, I couldn't work out a plea bargain. If that is really common, then that is news to me. But even if that's the case, then I think that there's an easy remedy, and that's for attorneys to just stop doing it. So with that, thank you very much.